some people suffer the phobia of lightning and thunder, which is called Caraunophobia technically. This is something, by the way, that Beethoven had very strongly, and he had this beautiful musical representation of the storm in his pastoral symphony. I worked with several people who had this problem, and psychodynamically this was linked to the very last part of the third matrix, when we suddenly get the connection to the light. The transition from the third matrix to the fourth matrix is not just the completion of the birth process and seeing the light that the child originally saw when he or she was being born, but the reliving of birth has kind of a psycho-spiritual dimension, in that the light that we are perceiving has a kind of a numinous quality. It's a spiritual experience, a reconnection with the divine domain. So in this sense, the lightning is a very appropriate symbol for that. For many people, the final stages of the third matrix are associated with fire, the experience of fire, when all these pent-up energies are now being kind of precipitously released. This creates feelings of heat, and this can be accompanied with actually visual experience of fire being burned or passing through fire. And the fire is experienced as kind of a purging fire. Now, people who are in connection with that aspect of the birth process, the one that's most immediately available to them from the unconscious, they have issues in relation to fire, depending on where they are in relation to this experience. Whether they are afraid of it, they would develop then pyrophobia, but they might also be attracted to it because they are then close to the completion of the experience, and they might become pyromaniac when they actually want to experience powerful fire and expect from it the kind of liberation and opening that they would get from the inner experience of the fire if this were a kind of inner transformation process. I will maybe mention just one more of the phobias, which is very common, and that's the fear of traveling, either in a train or in a car or in an airplane. Again, you know, whatever the other dimensions are, people usually find the perinatal dimension, where the basic idea is that you get into a very powerful mechanical system where you get closed and then you are carried and the movement is sort of beyond your control. Typically, people who have this fear, for example, in a car, they have that fear only if they are being driven. They don't have the fear if they are in control, if they actually can hold the wheel. So it's a fear of being kind of overpowered and carried in a system that doesn't allow, doesn't give us the opportunity to control it. We come to the next problem, which is depression. Depression can appear either in isolation, or in some people it appears in a way where it alternates with periods of mania. Now, depression is characterized by kind of low mood, lack of initiative, inability to enjoy things, and comes in two forms. One we can call inhibited depression, when there's also very little movement, the person is just kind of sitting there with no interest in the environment, self-absorbed. And the other form of depression is called agitated depression, where again there is very low mood, there is despair, there could be anxiety, but there is a lot of movement. The person, you know, again might hit the floor, might be kind of rolling around, hitting the head against the wall, tearing the hair, tearing the clothes, and so on. Mania, in a sense, is an opposite of the inhibited depression. Usually it's a state where there is euphoria that's kind of unnatural, almost forceful. There is a tendency to move around, to do a lot of things, go shopping, engage people in interaction, seek some kind of promiscuous sexual adventures, make fun of people, tell obscene jokes, and so on. There's a flight of thoughts, it's called fugue. Very rapid thinking, very rapid talking, rapid moving around. Now we have this sort of classical Freudian interpretation that this is a problem which is related to the active oral period. Now this doesn't explain many different important aspects of depression. doesn't tell us why the depression, it comes in these two forms, the inhibited depression, the agitated depression. It doesn't tell us why patients who are depressed feel that they are stuck, that they are in a kind of situation from which there is no way out. It's a kind of a no-exit, hopeless situation. It doesn't explain why patients who are depressed are physiologically blocked and also bioenergetically blocked. But there is a, you know, very, very concrete physical expression. These people feel actually oppressed and they feel pain and tension. When we do biochemical examinations, even in somebody who is in an inhibited depression, we find out that they're in a high state of stress, according to the biochemical indications. The depression has been described as sitting on the outside, running on the inside, so you don't see anything from the outside, but there is a kind of inner storm happening. None of that can really be explained from a situation, you know, where there's an orally frustrated, sort of lonely, abandoned infant and so on, which would be the kinds of situations that depression would be explained from. Now, when we work with depressed people using some methods involving non-ordinary states, like the breath work or the psychedelic work or some other form of therapy that's experiential and induces a non-ordinary state, we'll find out that they will find some situations first from their postnatal biography which are similar to those that are described by psychoanalysis. A situation of emotional deprivation, of abandonment, of rejection, of some kind of oral frustration, some serious problems in the early relationship with the mother. But on the biographical level, we also find some elements that psychoanalysis does not emphasize, such as situations where they are victimized, not just psychologically, but physically, some kind of painful interventions and so on. And then, as the process goes deeper and reaches the perinatal level, a person who is in the inhibited depression will suddenly realize that on a deeper level, they are in the second perinatal matrix, which means what they start suddenly experiencing is that that feeling of hopelessness and stuckness is really related to the situation of the first stage of biological delivery, where the uterus is contracting, is cutting off the blood supply, which means oxygen, nourishment, and the cervix is not open, a situation that feels unworkable, that feels absolutely hopeless. So depression seems to be like a projection of these feelings from an older situation into a current situation. And then suddenly we start understanding all the things which I described before, that this also could involve bioenergetic blockage. It's a situation that's very kind of hydraulic. You can also imagine how this situation would be physiologically blocking, why a person could have pressure headaches, why a person could experience pressure on the chest, pressure on the shoulders, why this should also be situation associated with stress rather than just sort of a sense of extinction. Now, when we have a person who is in an agitated depression, again, usually through some biographical material involving some kind of violent encounters and so on, that person would realize that on a deeper level, they are actually connected to the third matrix, where there is still a sense of confinement, but now the cervix is open, and so the energetic system is at least partially capable to discharge some of these energies. Not completely. If a person in agitated depression could really let it all hang out, could really express it fully, they would move out of the depression. Because on the unconscious level, they would move from the third matrix to the fourth. The confinement, the entrapment would be completely liquidated. So this is a situation where there is a partial release and sort of outflowing of these previously pent-up emotions and energies. Now, this is also very closely related to suicide. We know that, with the exception of suicide that have some really serious rational reason, like a Jewish person who escaped from a Nazi camp and knows that in the next moment they're going to be captured, or a person who has some kind of very painful terminal disease and is facing sort of days of suffering, where we can somehow understand that that person could commit suicide. if that is absent, then suicide is typically related to depression. Now, we have two major problems that any kind of serious theory of suicide would have to explain. The first one is why anybody would want to kill himself or herself. Because this seems to violate the most powerful instinct in nature, which is the self-preservation instinct that really drives the whole wheel of evolution. But we have another, even more interesting problem, which is why do people want to do it in a particular way? You see that people who are in a certain state of mind are attracted to a particular form of suicide. Let's say a person who would take an overdose of tranquilizers or barbiturates would not jump out of the window or under a train. Now, this might appear kind of understandable to us. If you just want to die, you find, instead of, you know, least gory kind of way to do it. But the opposite is also true, that a person who drives the car over the cliff, or the person who jumps out of the window or jumps under a train, would not take an overdose of drugs as a means to suicide, even if the drugs were available. So whether the person wants to commit suicide by hanging or drowning or by use of firearms itself requires some kind of explanation. Now, we can think in terms of two different types of suicide. Like we distinguish the inhibited depression and the agitated depression, there are also two categories of suicide. One is non-violent suicide. And we'll find that this is something that's on the mind of people who are in the inhibited depression, who are under the influence of the second matrix. When they cannot take it anymore, they find ways out of the situation. Now, the least problematic one would be they would end up in bed. They want to be covered by a blanket, and they just want to stay there, don't want to face the light of the day. The next step would be maybe take an overdose of tranquilizers, of barbiturates, or drinking a lot of alcohol. The next step then would be being attracted to water, wanting to end it by drowning. I've also worked with people in Prague when there was winter with snow and so on, who had fantasies of walking into the snow and just sort of walking until they fall down and that they would be covered with snow and they would kind of die there. The only bloody kind of suicide that is in this category was one that was in vogue kind of in ancient Rome, which is going into a bathtub with warm water and cutting the wrist so that the blood and the water kind of mix and we lose consciousness and kind of psychologically dissolve in the water. So how should we understand what is happening in people who are contemplating these kinds of forms of suicide? They are basically under the influence of the second matrix, which creates a lot of discomfort. And when they can't tolerate it anymore, the situation they're facing is that on the unconscious level, there is a memory that this situation wasn't always so, that before it was something that was better, particularly if it was a good womb, which was the prenatal situation. So they start looking for a way out that would bring in somehow the elements which on an unconscious level they remember from the prenatal state. So the most obvious one is water, because that is a situation where you're in water, then the idea is, you know, you want to drown. The one with the walking into the snow also has a kind of a prenatal fantasy behind it, because the fantasy is that it might be cold at the beginning, but that suddenly sort of warmth come in and the whole thing is just like a womb. The situation with the drugs, with alcohol, is very similar, because again it starts kind of eliminating the painful feeling and creates a kind of a state of undifferentiated indifference, which is like a caricature of the prenatal state. So if we work with these people using non-ordinary state, once they get to this level, they realize they really didn't want to kill themselves. They somehow wanted to escape from the uncomfortable situation of the second matrix into a situation which would have the elements of the first matrix. Now, they are not in touch with the unconscious where it's happening, so they perceive the depression as something that's caused by the current circumstances, and they also look for the solution by looking for situations in everyday life that would bring in some of the elements of the prenatal state. Now, if we look at the person who is in the agitated depression, that's a very different situation. The return to the womb is basically reduction, sort of alleviation of the uncomfortable feelings and bringing a kind of an undifferentiated state. In the third matrix, the resolution in the original situation came by intensification of the tension and kind of a sudden, explosive, catastrophic kind of a resolution, which happens in a messy situation where there is blood, you know, there are other forms of biological material, the placenta, the inside of the body comes out and so on. So what we see is that the person who is under the influence of the third matrix does not have the possibility that the person in the inhibited depression is, which is to simply undo that situation, go back to a previous memory, because the previous memory is the second matrix. Nobody would go from the third matrix to the second, because that looks like absolutely hopeless situation. That's hell, the second matrix. But what that person has available is the memory that after this situation there was something better, which was the actual situation of coming out. So we're facing a very interesting kind of paradoxical situation, that we were born anatomically in the original situation because we are here, we got out, but we really haven't completed it emotionally. So inside we still have the memory of the difficult stages. The little crying that the child does after birth does not really adequately process that tremendous event. So what we do, for example, in experiential therapy is belated processing, where we catch up somehow fully, consciously, with the awareness that we are already out of that situation, because deep in the unconscious we still feel caught and trapped. So the circumstances of the birth process are used as a kind of recipe for the psychological completion of the process. Now, this means sort of bringing the situation to some kind of catastrophic resolution, where it's sort of instantly over and it is a messy situation. So this would then lead to things like firearms, or driving the car over the cliff, or jumping out of the window, harakiri, those kinds of things. The impulses for hanging seem to come from a strong unconscious memory of choking in the birth canal, where the person is trying to exteriorize those feelings. In some sense, as destructive as it is when it's acted out, there is a kind of distorted healing impulse, because if the person could have these experiences in a protected environment where it's an inner experience rather than it's acted out, it would actually lead to liberation. It would lead to a kind of a deep dynamic shift from the third matrix to the fourth matrix. So they psychologically now would be in a frame of mind which was more like being out of the birth canal rather than being stuck in it. So if we now sum it up, we find out that people who are suicidal actually do not want to kill themselves. This answers the first question, how come people ignore the self-preservation instinct? It's really not about killing oneself. People want to reach either the postnatal state of mind or the prenatal state of mind, because the second and the third matrix are so uncomfortable. But if we do it as adults, as in kind of an experiential psychotherapy, as I mentioned before, those experiences will not be just a replay of the original situation, but they would have a kind of numinous quality, so that the experience of the prenatal state would not be just being the fetus in the womb, but there would also be a feeling of mystical oneness, of cosmic unity and so on. It would be a spiritual state at the same time. And in a similar way, the experience of being born or reborn is also a kind of a psycho-spiritual experience. There is a sense of connecting with the numinous dimension. So from this perspective, they don't want just to reach the prenatal and the postnatal situation, but they actually want to reach the spiritual dimension. So we can see suicide as really a result of a kind of unrecognized craving for transcendence. What people who are under the influence of the third matrix want is not suicide, but egocide. They want the ego death that would actually be a kind of a preamble for a powerful spiritual opening and spiritual reconnection. So it's a kind of a tragic misunderstanding and failure to read correctly the impulses that are coming from the unconscious. Now, this would result also in a new strategy in relation to self-destructive suicidal patients. We would not tell them when we are seeing them that they are sick, they are depression, and this is why they feel that they want to die. We would sort of see the need to die as an authentic sort of psychological need. So the approach would be actually to help them die, but do it safely, sort of show them that they can have the experience of death followed by rebirth, and that to have the experience of death, they don't have to hurt the body. They would sort of move out of that state, and actually, after having the experience of dying, they would feel much more alive and much more connected to life. Now, the question is now, how is mania related to depression? Why do we talk about the bipolar disorder? We have seen repeatedly, particularly in the psychedelic work, but occasionally in the holotropic work, mania come as a kind of a symptom or an indication of incomplete rebirth. People would be struggling to be born, and there would be a kind of a partial opening, but the process would not be complete. And at that point, people would refuse to continue. I remember situations from the psychedelic work, particularly when it's very marked. And the person now is, you know, forcefully euphoric and would start praising the program. He says, this is incredible, this is a wonderful experience, everybody should have it, you know, we'll go and give it to the politicians and this is going to change the world, and where's the telephone, I'm going to call all my friends and we're going to throw a party, we're going to celebrate, this was a, you know, great experience. And at the same time, when you watch them, you see that it's not genuine happiness. They certainly don't want to analyze where they are or receive some kind of instructions what they should do, which of course would be to go back into the process and complete it, because they're kind of like halfway out. So we can say that the inhibited depression is basically the influence of the second matrix, which is a system which is completely closed and feels like an absolute no exit situation. The agitated depression would be a situation where the energy starts sort of partially flowing out, and the manic state would be one step beyond that, when now you still have this activity which you have in the agitated depression or even more, but now instead of getting depression, you get kind of this forceful kind of caricature. There's one more category of issues, of disorders that I would like to explore. And those are problems involving sexuality, which means sexual dysfunctions, aberrations, deviations, perversions, you know, whatever terminology we want to use for that. And this is, I think, particularly interesting because of the importance that Freud attributes to sexuality in psychology. One of his major contributions was actually an essay on sexuality, where he brought up the thesis of the libidinal development, the oral, the anal, urethral, phallic, and he made a link there between perversions and neurosis, that somehow acting out the what he called the it impulses, the impulses of the instincts associated with the unconscious, uninhibited acting out would lead to perversions, whereas neurosis could be seen as a kind of a defense and a reaction formation against these kinds of instinctual libidinal impulses. Now, he had quite a few problems in this area. His initial conceptual framework implied that the most powerful motivating force in our psyche is what he called the pleasure principle, which is the need to pursue pleasure and avoid displeasure. And then around the year 1913 or so, he became aware, very, very strongly aware of the fact that there are quite a few disorders where this explanation simply doesn't apply. And the most blatant example was, of course, masochism, where there are people who want to be tortured, they want to suffer, they want to experience pain, they want to be abused. There are people who mutilate themselves, there are people who have the compulsion to confess. And in the extremes, there are people who kill themselves. So all these problems, you know, could not be easily interpreted as pursuit of pleasure, and he became aware of the problem. And he started thinking about it. He wrote a book, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, dealing with these issues. And then as he was writing papers and books dealing with this problem, more and more the issue of death started kind of creeping into his thinking. He originally believed that death is absolutely irrelevant in psychology, and the reason for this was that the unconscious was kind of timeless. It did not know death. So when he was working with patients who had, for example, a phobia of death, he didn't see it as anything related to death, but to some other issues, like this was a fear of a powerful orgasm, or it was a fear of losing control, or it was maybe an aggressive impulse, so that the individual wants to kill somebody but starts sort of having fear for his or her own life. Now, what came out of this was a completely new, different system of psychoanalysis, where the psyche was now a battlefield between two powerful instincts. One he called libido, and the other one was the death instinct that he called thanatos. Some people talk about libido and destrudo. So eros, thanatos, libido, destrudo, those are the same kind of things. Now this thanatos replaced the self-preservation instinct. In Freud's original thinking, the psyche was also a kind of a battlefield, but the two rivals were libido, the sexual instinct, and then the self-preservation instinct, or the ego instinct. Now, there was a new way of thinking about the psyche, where the conflict was between sex and death, basically. And in one of his last essays, which is called An Outline of Psychoanalysis, he completely redid psychoanalysis, a major, major overhaul, a very new way of thinking. The interesting thing is that this was not accepted by the majority of his followers. So in a sense, it remained unanswered, the question of sadomasochism and other deviations. When we work with non-ordinary states, the key to the understanding of many sexual problems is the fact that, as I mentioned before, the second matrix has a very strong sexual component, that somehow the pain and particularly the choking that is involved in birth somehow creates a state of strong arousal that is either identical or very close to sexual arousal. And that puts our first experience of sexuality into a very precarious kind of a situation where our life is threatened, we are hurting, we are inflicting pain on another organism is inflicting pain on us, we are choking, we experience aggression as a kind of response to this vital threat, we experience anxiety, of course, and we are in touch with various forms of biological material. There is blood there, there is the fetal liquid, there could be even feces and urine if there was no catheter, if there was no enema involved. So we can see how this could create a very natural basis in connection with some later postnatal experiences for a variety of sexual deviations or dysfunctions or perversions, because all these elements are linked quite naturally in the situation. If we read kind of a handbook of sexual pathology, we'll find out that it involves a link between sex and anxiety, sex and aggression, sex and pain inflicted on somebody, sex and pain inflicted on us, bondage, wanting to be confined, wanting to be choked, or bringing in biological material like urine and feces into a sexual situation, or in the extreme linking death and sex, sort of sexual murder or violence, rape, and so on. So we have a very natural way of looking at some of the deeper roots of these disorders. And then we, of course, in the larger cartography, we have also then things like karmic dimension. We have also the archetypal dynamics that can sort of feed into these kinds of problems. In some instances, even phylogenetic kind of a element, like when we have an extreme disorder like necrophilia associated with cannibalism that seemed to bring in some kind of animal elements from the consciousness of scavengers and so on. So we have a much richer, multidimensional way of looking at these problems rather than trying to explain them just from postnatal events. So I will specifically mention now several of these kinds of issues, beginning with what used to be called impotence and frigidity. Those are kind of politically incorrect terms now. We're talking about the inability to develop erection or maintain erection in men, and then the inability to have an orgasm or have a full orgasm in women. Now, these are usually seen as kind of a minus phenomena. Let's say impotence, inability to develop erection, as kind of lack of masculine power, and in women the inability to have an orgasm as lack of sensitivity, as the old term frigidity kind of indicates. When we do experiential work with people who have these problems, we'll find that exactly the opposite is true, that the people who have these problems, they sit on an enormous amount of difficult emotions and difficult physical sensations that are all entangled with their sexuality, typically linked to the third matrix. Now, the third matrix in the unconscious is so close to consciousness that they cannot separate their everyday sexuality from engaging with the material of the third matrix. So when they get sexually aroused, it starts bringing up the memory of the third matrix with all these problematic elements that I was talking about, so that it's impossible just to have ordinary sex, and the tendency to hold down this very powerful material then interferes with the sexual functioning. So the approach then is to create a non-sexual situation in which, in regressive work, people could go back and then express in a non-sexual context these powerful emotions, process the anxiety, the aggression, whatever else is there. Now, the proof that this is a correct interpretation is that when, let's say, a man who was unable to have an erection releases a lot of this unconscious material and comes to the point where sex becomes possible, we actually get a transitional period of exaggerated sexuality, which is clinically called satyriasis, sort of, you know, spontaneous erections happening and the capacity to have sex several times in a night, but not reaching really full release, so that very shortly after the orgasm, the energy starts building up. Essentially, what happened here is that the material of the third matrix, whatever is left of it now, found the connection to the genitals, and the person is not just having ordinary sex, but is now discharging this enormous energy that comes from a deeper level, from the perinatal level. Now, in a very similar way, if a woman discharges enough of that destructive unconscious material and comes to the point where the orgasm becomes possible, typically the initial orgasms are enormous. So again, this is not ordinary sexuality, but it's this kind of deeper energy that we frequently see manifesting in experiential work is now sort of using the sexual channel. Now, the situation with coprophagia and coprophilia is quite interesting. In Freudian analysis, the idea is that we are basically animal, our deepest nature is bestial, and so we're attracted to biological secreta and excreta, the way a dog is, for example, or even little children. We see some little children, you know, attracted and not having any kind of a squeamishness about feces, for example, able to smear themselves or taste it and so on. So the idea in psychoanalysis is that on a deep level we are attracted to this material, and then of course comes the superego, comes the society that doesn't allow it, and the repressive influence is mediated through the parents and becomes our superego. But on a deeper level we still remain attracted to this material. And then if the conflict is too strong, we can then develop a neurosis as a compromise formation. Now, the insights from the deep experiential work are different, which is that we can have a negative or a positive early encounter with this material as part of our birth process. For example, I've worked with a couple of people who were coprophiliacs, and they both had an experience where there was feces in their delivery, where there was no enema. This is a very common thing if there's no enema applied. So that as they were emerging into the world after this prolonged struggle and tension and fear, and also the sexual buildup, which was part of it, as they kind of emerged, the ambience was this material. So it somehow became symbol of the sort of complete release, which then was sought also in later sexual life. It was reactivated by some postnatal sort of experiences in infancy and childhood, which could be of the kind that Freud was talking about. I will mention one more situation, which I've also described in the book Beyond the Brain, which is a little interesting paperback, and it's called A Sexual Profile of Men in Power. And basically it was a study done by three professionals on the East Coast, and it was a study of prostitutes, very high-class call girls, sort of in the category of like Christine Keeler in the Profumo affair in England. So their clients were like very highly positioned men who were senators and governors, and there was one Supreme Court judge who was among the clients and so on. Now the study was very interesting because it was not the study of the prostitutes. They were not asking the question, why did these girls become prostitutes? It was the study of the clients. And the idea was, if there were not clients who have these kinds of demands and interests, you know, these girls would be out of business. So let's look at the clients. Now what they found out is that these men in absolute minority came just for straight sex. They were coming from situations where it was not difficult to just to have sex. They were coming with very, very specific kind of deviant ways of satisfying their sexuality. And they have frequently very specific ideas. It was kind of heavy, kinky sex in some instances. So they had a list of things that they were offering with prices on them. One was called golden shower, which was being peed on in the sexual situation. One was called the brown shower, which was being defecated on. They were willing to stage some very complex situations, which were fantasies that the clients came with and wanted to experience, like pretending that this was a situation where an American pilot was shot during the Second World War in Nazi Germany, and these girls were dressed as Gestapo women with helmets and with boots and so on, and they would do bondage and they would sort of whip the client, and then the release, the orgasm would happen in this kind of bondage situation. I know a similar situation which was not in the book, but it was something that a friend of mine told me. He had as a client a prostitute from the red light district there, and so he got a lot of stories from her, and they had one situation that was by far in the greatest demand, where the client could have three girls dressed like nuns in a closed room where he had the key, so he was controlling the situation. And he was chasing them, and they were pretending that they were frightened, so it was a kind of a fake rape. And while this was happening, they were playing sacred music through a sort of hi-fi system. So it's a very typical third matrix situation where there is a, you know, sexuality, aggression, fear, but at the same time, this peculiar kind of a mixture. So back to the sexual profile of men in power. In many of these clients, after whatever the scene was that they enacted, after the orgasm, they actually wanted to be held naked, and they wanted to suck on the breast. So these were psychoanalytically oriented researchers. So they interpreted these situations using psychoanalytic jargon. So for example, when it was the golden shower or the brown shower, it had something to do with toilet training and anal fixation. If it was whipping, it was need for parental punishment. If they wanted to be held on the breast and sucking, this was a regression to the oral level and so on. But when we take a closer look, what many or most of these situations were about were actually enactment of the birth situation, where the bondage and the torture, including the scatological aspect, the feces and the urine and so on, were really elements present in birth. And then after this was over, then the breast came. So it was not regression to the breast, but actually from their perspective, psychological progression, because they were under the influence of the perinatal matrix. And there was a very interesting conclusion that they made when they basically said that they found that these were people in power. These were, you know, highly ambitious men who were coming for these kinds of situations. So they concluded that men who have very strong ambition to the point that they are striving for political places and so on, they also have very strong libido that can take kind of deviant forms. So that the American public shouldn't expect that politicians would be like models of moral behavior, that if you want a politician, you get a package, sort of that you shouldn't be surprised when these things are happening. Now, that raises a very interesting question that has something to do with the psychology of Freud versus the psychology of another renegade, which is Alfred Adler, who challenged Freud, and he put down the significance of sexuality, which was emphasized by Freud, and he himself emphasized something else, which was the inferiority complex, sense of inadequacy, and a tendency to overcompensate it as being actually the most powerful driving force in the psyche. Now, on a level of thinking which is just postnatally biographical, this is a significant distinction, because for Freud, people want power because it gives them better sexual opportunities. For Adler, people want power and they use sex to get power. And of course, in everyday life, we see both instances. Different people approach it differently. But if we bring in the model that includes the perinatal dimension, we see that we can sort of bring these two together, that in the third matrix, the child is exposed to a situation which is so overbearing, so demanding, that it's sort of way above his or her head. So there's a feeling of inadequacy and helplessness, but at the same time, it's a life-threatening situation. So there's this desperate effort to overcome it anyway and to get sort of on top of it, so that both of those sides are present. And at the same time, this pain and the choking is create this tremendous sexual tension that wants discharge. So on the perinatal level, the Adlerian and the Freudian dimension are just two sides of the same coin. So we could continue like this. We could go to a number of other emotional disorders and psychosomatic disorders, but I think these are the main examples that are enough to show how our understanding of psychopathology, or what's called traditionally psychopathology, would change if we approach it in the context of this larger cartography. Now, I have talked a lot about birth and the birth trauma and the importance of the birth trauma, which could very easily leave you with the impression that I'm talking here somehow about causal influences, that somehow all these problems are caused by the birth trauma, which is a way that I saw it initially, because I was coming from a traditional medical training, from a traditional psychiatric training, and from a Freudian training, where there is a tendency to reduce somehow psychology to biology. But I was also mentioning that these problems have then a very significant transpersonal dimension, and there is a vast domain in the psyche which is really beyond the perinatal, and in my present understanding, in a sense, even supraordinated to the perinatal and the biographical. So the way I see it now is that we're basically dealing here with archetypal fields of energy that find their manifestation either on the transpersonal level or the perinatal level or the biographical level. So today I would see actually biological birth itself being a manifestation of a certain sequence of archetypal patterns, rather than trying to explain, for example, archetypes from biological birth. There's a whole other dimension which would require a special seminar. I've done now a lot of work together with Rick Tarnas, who is an excellent astrologer, also a person who is very knowledgeable about non-ordinary states of consciousness. He wrote his dissertation in psychology on psychedelic therapy. And what we have found out is that there is tremendous correlation between experiences in non-ordinary states and astrological archetypes, particularly in relation to transits. For example, just very briefly, if we look at the four perinatal matrices, which is something that I formulated long before I had any notion of astrology, there is a striking similarity to four major astrological archetypes. Of course, the first matrix is the oceanic, the cosmic, which in astrological terms would be certainly related to Neptune. The second matrix is about oppression, compression, depression, starvation, guilt, and so on, which is very Saturnian. Quite amazing is the third matrix, which is powerful energies, birth, sex, death, rebirth, and also scatology, elimination, biological excreta, and so on, all those in astrology would be linked to Pluto. And then the fourth matrix would be defined as sudden, unexpected resolution of a difficult situation, breakthrough, insights, epiphany, and so on. And in astrological terms, that would be Uranus. So this similarity itself is very interesting, but what is absolutely mind-blowing is that if we then study specifically people who have these experiences, you'll find out that they actually would have experiences of these matrices at the time when they have these planets that I mentioned as significant transits. So astrology can be used as a way of predicting what kind of experiences people will have in non-ordinary states. So my current thinking is more in terms of archetypal psychology, to see that what we're dealing with are sort of archetypal patterns, archetypal gestalts, and whether they will have a transpersonal expression or perinatal or biological, then would be a separate issue. But none of these three domains would be really supraordinated to any other. They would all be expressions of the archetypal. We have so far discussed new understanding of emotional and psychosomatic disorders, which is quite interesting in itself. But what's quite exciting is that this new understanding also offers, you know, completely new therapeutic strategy, new mechanisms of healing, of transformation, of consciousness evolution, which are not available as long as we think in terms of the old conceptual frameworks. And this is something that we'll explore in the next part.